So my hope is, while Mark asked me to come and speak on apologetics, which is something I'm passionate about and I care about deeply, my hope is that I'm going to cram it all in, and maybe this Friday on my last day, we can have some fun with Hebrew, and I'll throw in a little Greek just for grins, because I understand some of you haven't started your Hebrew yet. But I've got a book that Baylor University published a year and a half ago on the Torah, and I'm going to get, we'll find out how many students there are. I'm sending you a cases of them, because they're daily readings in the Torah, and they're teachings, but also devotional thoughts. And I wrote them as a Christian, but I also wrote them with a Hebrew audience in mind, a Jewish audience. And so I think you may really enjoy it. But for this morning, I'm into apologetics, and I do keep a PowerPoint. I hope you can see it. I know it's harder for you guys over there, but hopefully it will help. And as Mark told you, I do live with feet in two different worlds. And so I've got the law world, and I live in that, and that's how I make my living. Mark and I have talked about me coming over here for several years, and I just haven't been able to do it because I'm very active in courts. I'm supposed to be in court this week. I've got a judge who gave me special permission because I told him I have promised to come to South Africa for this. And he has given me special permission to be here. But that's what I do. And I travel all over the United States and into Canada and even into the United Kingdom for legal purposes and that part of my life and legal work. So I have the law as part of what I do, but I also have faith as another shoe that I wear. My faith is not simply what I believe, but it is my passion. When I was growing up, I really wanted to consider being a preacher or a teacher. And so I took, within the denomination that I grew up in, I took a seminary degree, in essence. And I had an offer to preach at a church. But I grew up in a very narrow denomination that had very narrow views. And my views of Christianity had expanded beyond the realm of that. And so my personal preacher, pastor at the time, counseled me, and he said that I needed to pursue a career in law, but do it where I was doing it to fund the preaching. So he said, do the preaching as your passion, but don't rely on it for your income, because you'll either change jobs every 6 months when they figure out what you believe. Because I didn't believe the narrowness of the denomination. He said, or you'll get so good at hiding it that you'll lose the passion. And he said, so hold on to your truth, but don't lose that, but don't use that for your means. So I went into law, and it's been a really interesting endeavor. Now, I'm not the first Christian lawyer. As Mark has already indicated, Simon Greenleaf is a good example, but we can go back. Do you take church history at all here? Tertullian, who came up with the phrase of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Tertullian was a lawyer. The Apostle Paul was legally trained at the feet of Gamaliel, one of the top lawyers in Jerusalem. So we come to the church, some early, some late, but we come nonetheless. And it's really interesting what happens when you do. So I was at a legal conference where I was teaching in a state in the U.S. called Arizona. And there was a dinner one night. And as I was at the dinner, there was a lawyer named Mike Dyer. And Mike Dyer, I came up to the table and I was greeting some of the people, and Mike was there, and he said, so you believe you're a Christian? And I said, yes. He said, well, I'd love to have you try and prove that to me, because I think that's just absurd. And I said, well, okay, I'd be delighted to do it. And I had a conversation with Mike that I'm going to weave into some of what we're to talk about this morning. But it's part of my life with a feet in two different worlds. So if we look at how those worlds can merge, let's do a little work on the PowerPoint here and get it all set up. Faith and law go back and forth for me. I'm a lawyer in my day job, but I'm doing it so I can be a faithful servant to the Lord, not only in how I am a lawyer and in what I do as a lawyer, but also in the teaching that I try to do as well. But it has affected the way my mind works. And Mark referenced a book that IVP published, Christianity on Trial. I've been honored to have it. It's in English, a British copy as well, a British version. And then it's been translated into Korean and into Croatian. And now it's coming out in Spanish. So I've got a set of those coming over here, and they should be here this week, hopefully before I leave, so that everybody can have a copy or two or three, and however many we've got sent, and then you can give them away. But read it first. My wife, when it first came out, my wife and I had just flown back to the United States from somewhere overseas, and I had to immediately go to work, so I didn't go home. So Becky, my wife, went home while I went to a different place. And I called her the next day, worried about her jet lag. And I said, "So how did you sleep last night?" And she said, "I was wide awake. Couldn't go to sleep at all." And I said, "Oh, I'm really sorry." She said, No. It gave me a chance to start your book that just came out." And I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, I read one page and fell sound asleep." So I'm going to retitle it Ambien, which is a sleeping drug in the United States. And this will really help you go to sleep. But I wrote the book because some people think the Christian faith doesn't make sense. Some people believe Christianity makes no sense at all, like my friend Mike Dyer, the lawyer. Now, I'm a Christian because it makes the most sense to me. I would love to tell you, "Oh, I'm a Christian because God brought me up into his presence in heaven and he laid out all of these things for me." He has not done that for me. I'd love to tell you I'm a Christian because I was born into a family with Christian parents. Well, I was, and I'm thankful for that, but that's not why I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian because it makes the most sense to me. I mean, intellectual sense. I think maybe I'm going to change a little bit of what I was doing this week, because you've all had Greek, or you're taking Greek. Okay, so pistuo is a Greek verb. Means I believe. Pistuo, but it means more than that. And so pistis is the noun, and we can translate it as faith, but it means so much more than an intellectual knowledge. It means a trust. It means a conviction. And I'm afraid that in our efforts to make Greek make sense in English, sometimes we lose so much of the Greek. And so I really want to pursue some of that with you, and we'll look at some of that in some more detail. But the way I'm starting today is I've got three things I want to talk to you about in the next 30 minutes. The first is just some legal stuff. And I'm sorry, I know you're not in law school, but I'm going to put you through law school in about 10 minutes. And so in 10 minutes, you'll be able to walk out on the street and say, "I'm not a lawyer, but I could be." So we're going to do a little bit of law school for about 10 minutes, maybe even a little less. And then I want to apply your legal education to faith. And I want you to see how those two intersect with each other. And then I'm also going to lay out for you some ideas of where we'd like to go this week, and the things I want to talk to you about. So with those being the three things we're going to do, let's start with law school. And Mike Dyer, who I was talking to, is a lawyer. And he said to me, he said, "Mark, can you prove the existence of God to me? Can you prove that God is there?" Now, a lot of people get asked that question, and the very standard Christian response to "can you prove the existence of God" is to say, "No, you take that based upon faith." But the Greek word faith, pistis, does not mean this Kierkegaardian blind leap off of a cliff, hoping that there's something there below that's going to save you. The Greek word for faith, pistis, is one that includes a mental awareness and a knowledge and a reasonable thinking. And so when we talk about can you prove God, we're falling, the Christians who say no, you must take it on faith, A, are wrong, and B, do not understand what faith means in the biblical sense. Because my answer to him, to Mike, was, yes, I can prove it. Absolutely. I think I can prove the existence of God. Now, I hope you're bothered by what I'm saying. I hope you're saying, you can't prove the existence of God, because I'm going to prove to you I can. Here's the question. What is proof?
You got a lawyer up here. Don't play games with me.
What is proof? Now, I'm not up here. God is not chemistry class. So if you want proof like you do in a chemistry lab, well, of course you can't prove God. He's not a chemistry exam or a chemistry experiment. So don't think you're going to prove him the way you'd prove if something's an acid or a base or some chemistry issue. And this is not math class. So don't use math proof to try to prove the existence of God. We think proof must be something like, well, in math, you have to prove that what is the measurement of the hypotenuse of a right triangle? Well, C squared equals A squared plus B squared. And you can figure these things out, and you can prove that 5 minus 2 equals 3 because 3 plus 2 equals 5. Okay, that works for math. You can prove that. But everything has its own nature and kind of proof. And you can't cross them up. See, you can't play soccer with rugby rules. You can't pick up the ball and run over everybody and throw it in the goal. Now, that doesn't mean soccer rules aren't good rules for soccer. But there's no handball. Rugby rules are good rules for rugby, but you don't just dribble around with your feet. Through the scrum, you pick at the ball and it's a different game played by different rules. So when we talk about how do you prove God, don't let anyone try to use chemistry proof or math proof. Look, how tall is Johnny? That's asking for a measurement. Well, I do not want to measure Johnny with a thermometer. Now, the thermometer is very good for measuring temperature, but the thermometer is not going to measure how tall Johnny is. How tall is Johnny? He's 40 degrees. He's a rather hot man. So I live in a courtroom. And in a courtroom, what I have to do is prove things. I prove things for a living. I've made a lot of money proving things. I've put a lot of bad guys away proving things.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's it. Witness.
This is what I do. Mark is right. You Google my name and you'll see I've proven a lot of things in my life. So when I have to prove something in court, we don't, a jury does not sit there, or a judge does not sit there and decide things with a chemistry test. In South Africa, you have a court system. In fact, this picture is from the court in Cape Town. And in Cape Town, if you're going to go into court and prove a civil case, I read some of your law. Okay? If you're going to go prove a civil case, you have to prove it by what are called the preponderance of possibilities. The preponderance of possibilities. Let me tell you what that means. That means you sit there and you look at the reasonable possibilities or probabilities. What could probably be true? You look at them. You look at the evidence. You put that evidence into scales and you weigh that evidence fairly. You decide what evidence is credible, what evidence is not credible. What's more believable? What's not as believable? And you put all of the evidence in the scales and then you make a decision. What is most likely among these possibilities? And that's how you prove things. Now, if it's a criminal case and you're going to lock someone away, you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a greater movement of the scales, where you no longer have a reasonable doubt. But to prove things in a civil case, it's what is more likely than not. And that's proving something. Now you say, well, that's not really proving. Oh, yes, it is. You can put someone in jail based on proving like that. In Texas, where I come from, you can put someone to death based on proving that. You can take someone's children away from them based on proving that. You can bankrupt a business based on proving that. You can bring the government to its knees based on proving that. So what you've got to do is fairly weigh the evidence. So you've got to weigh the evidence that's yes, there is a God, against the evidence of no, there's not. Put them in the scales and decide which one is more likely than not. That's proof. Okay? You've made it through half of law school. You've got one more class you got to take. It's called evidence. So if we're going to fairly weigh the evidence, you need to know there are two types of evidence. One type is eyewitness evidence. This is where I see it. I was in New York City one day. I was paying for breakfast at the deli where my wife and I had eaten breakfast. And there, as I'm, if you are the cashier, I am standing at the cash register. And right here where this screen is the glass front to the restaurant. And I just happened to look to my left and I saw this fella pull out a gun and I saw him start shooting down the street. I mean, I saw the flame come out the end of the gun. I heard it. I watched him. Bam! Bam! And I hit the ground, start crawling back to my wife, immediately thinking, well, this is New York. They're filming something. I'm an idiot. Everybody's looking at me thinking, oh, stupid boy from Texas. Until I realized everyone else had gone down too and were under the tables. When that fella who shot some lady in the leg, he wasn't a very good shot. When that fella was going to trial, I was the star witness because I was an eyewitness. I saw it. So that's evidence that I could offer. You with me? There's a whole second kind of evidence, though, that's called circumstantial evidence. And that's where the circumstances make you believe one thing or another. The classic example that's used in law school is, if I'm outside when it's raining and I'm looking at the rain, I am an eyewitness and I can tell you it's raining. But if instead of being outside, I'm inside and I hear thunder and I hear against the windows splat, 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 and I see Mark Dixon come in wearing a raincoat with water all over it, an umbrella that he's shaking out with water going everywhere as he... I can say, I think it's raining outside, with some reasonable confidence, because the circumstances lead to that as a reasonable conclusion. So circumstantial evidence. In a criminal case, by the way, fingerprints, that's circumstantial evidence. That's not an eyewitness. Nobody saw you put your fingerprint there. But that's a circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence, the courts say in South Africa, in the United States, in England, in Korea, and Germany, those are the places I've looked thus far. The courts all say consistently across the line, circumstantial evidence is just as significant as eyewitness evidence. In fact, oftentimes more convincing and more important and more reliable. Say, oh, that doesn't make sense. Yes, it does. Eyewitnesses can often get things wrong. And memory can be kind of shaky. So we understand that eyewitness testimony is not always the strongest. In fact, it rarely is. You look to prove things with the circumstances. What makes most sense? Now let me give you a test. Was Napoleon at Waterloo? How many of you believe he was? How many of you don't care? The don't cares win. Did Hitler oversee and was he in some way responsible for the slaughtering of Jews? How many believe yes? Okay. Was the slave trade a horrendous human tragedy that occurred? How many of you believe yes? Okay. Now, how many of you were eyewitnesses to Hitler? Okay, one or two of you. You believe that based upon circumstantial evidence. You say, well, it's not circumstantial evidence. I believe it based upon reading what eyewitnesses said. Ah. Reading what eyewitnesses said. Did you watch them write it? Ultimately, it's all circumstantial evidence. Let me ask you this. Do I love my wife? That's our new little grandson. His name is John Henry. Do I love my wife? In a courtroom, if I had to prove I love my wife, how would I do that? If there's an American basketball player, Kobe Bryant. He died last night in a helicopter crash. And if Kobe Bryant's wife said to me, Mark, I want you to represent me in this lawsuit. One of the things I would have to prove for her is, if for her to win damages, is that Kobe loved his wife. Now, how would I do that? Is there an eyewitness? You can't prove love the way you prove a chemistry experiment. You can't prove love the way you prove a mathematic formula. But that doesn't mean love's not real. It means you've got to use the right kind of proof. So you look at the evidence, you look at the circumstances, you look what people see, and you put it in and you say, well, what's the most reasonable explanation for this? And that's how you prove it. So one of the things we've got to do is decide, what explains this world where we live? What explains why things are the way they are? My friends tell me, well, evolution has proven that for why the world is the way it is, and there is no need for God. Well, I don't need to fuss that with anybody. That's not my issue. I mean, I ultimately do want to know, okay, well, where did this stuff come from? Even evolution somewhere goes back to stardust. Where'd the stardust come from? Where'd the Big Bang come from? And I'm not saying those aren't valid questions and that's not a valid line of pursuit. But when I say, what explains the world where we live? I'm concerned about something a little closer to home. I'm trying to fit together these pieces of the world that explain how an Adolf Hitler could come about and be. See, I'm really bothered by how an Adolf Hitler could exist. So I was speaking at an American college, Christian college called Wheaton. And when I was up there to speak at chapel, I was also asked to come in and guest lecture at a class. And the class was entitled, Sharing Your Faith. So I had 42 Wheaton students who were spending a lot of money to take this class on how to share their faith. They cared that much. And I told the professor, Jerry Root, I said, Jerry, do you care what I do for the hour I have your students? He said, no. And I said, well, tell me what you've been doing. He said, well, we just went out on a weekend with a bus. And everybody had to go find people. And we're trying to practically share our faith and do the things that I've taught. And da da da. And I said, okay, got it. Thank you. So here's what I did. I went in and I handed every student a sheet of paper. And I said, I want you to do something. I do not know you. I'll never see you again. I don't know any of your names. I will never recognize your handwriting. So what you put down here is to be truly anonymous. Because I'm going to ask you a question about what's deep in your heart, and I want you to write down the honest answer. And I don't want you to have any fear that anyone will ever see it. Now hide it like you do your CashPoint ATM number, you know, like this. You write it down, you fold it over, you bring it to me, I'll read these, I'll personally put them in the trash. You never have to worry. So everybody got a sheet of paper, everybody got their pen. I said, here's what I want you to write. What is your biggest personal challenge to believing in God? You're all taking a course about sharing your faith. But I wonder what your personal faith questions are. So write it down. So all 42 students wrote it down, folded it up. I took them. I said, class is in recess for 5 minutes. And in 5 minutes, I managed to read through them and sort them into piles. 75% of them, their biggest challenge to faith was something about the tragedies in this world. How could, if there's a loving, all-powerful God, how could he allow the crack addict who's a prostitute to have a baby and bring a life into this world? those are huge questions. They merit serious consideration and discussion. But we've got to decide what explains this world in which we live. We've got to decide what explains you and me. Why do we care about the things we care about? Why do we talk about what fairness is or justice or what love is? Why are we the way we are? Why does it bother us that it seems things seem unfair at times? So these are the questions that I think we need to be answering. And these are questions that are really, is God real? We need to ask those questions and we need to answer those questions. And proof is accumulating the evidence that says, yes, he's real, or no, he's not real. Let's put that evidence into the scales and let's make our decision. What do we prove? And that's legal stuff. So faith application is easy. I said to Mike, Mike, why do you care about right and wrong? I don't understand. If there is no God, why do you care about right and wrong? He said, well, I'm a golden rule atheist. And I said, what is that? And he said, I'm an atheist who believes you should treat others the way you'd like to be treated. I said, why? If there's no God, I say get everything you can. If there's no God, I say take advantage of anyone you can. Well, that's not very nice. I said, what does nice mean if there's no God? As long as you don't get caught. Did Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, all of that? That makes it over here? You know, he based that in part on Plato's story of a man named Gyges who found a ring. And when Gyges put on the ring, Gyges, in essence, disappeared. He could do things and no one would know it was him. And Gyges was a very good man until Gyges had the ring long enough that he could get away with doing things. And Gyges became very evil and corrupt because it could never be traced back to him. And the story of Gyges' ring was Plato's way of saying we can act like we're very moral and we're very upright, but it's always because we're afraid we're going to get caught. And if you took away the fear of getting caught, we would all be wicked. It's just a matter of time. I said, if there's no God, why are you a golden rule person? That makes no sense to me. He says, well, it just seems right to want to be that way. And I said, do you know why, Mike? He said, why? I said, because you're a moral being who's been made in the image of a moral God. So hardwired into your brain like a computer program is this idea of right and wrong. I said, it's not there for others. I said, honestly, in the animal world, how many sharks do you know who live by the golden rule? Hey, seriously, how many sharks do you know that say, well, I would eat you, little fishy, but I'm going to do unto you as I would have you do unto me, and I know you would not want to eat me. I mean, do you think the shark has any moral problem with devouring what's in front of it? And he said, well, maybe, I don't know, it just seems right. I said, Mike, why is it that you care about right and wrong? I said, if there's no God. I said, why do you, he says, well, I care about people. I said, why? And I said, you don't really care about people. You actually care more about some other things. And he said, what do you mean? I said, is your grandmother still alive? And he said, no, she died a few weeks ago. I said, did you, what'd y'all do? Did y'all eat her afterwards? He looked at me and said, what? I said, did y'all like have a feast and cook her body up and eat her? He said, of course not. And I said, why did you throw away all that good protein, calcium? He said, well, you don't eat people. I said, you're eating a steak right now. Well, yeah, I love steak. I said, what's the difference? What makes humans so special if there's no God? He says, well, she was my Grammy. I said, do you think your Grammy would want you to throw away good food? He said, I don't even think I would. I think there's a health problem with eating it. And I said, well, did you feed her to the pigs so you could eat the pigs? Then there's no health problem. Well, that's not. I said, do you understand that if we're going to ask this question of why are we the way we are, it includes the question of why do we see value and dignity in humanity? So we've got to fairly weigh this evidence. We've got to decide with morality. Why do we believe in right and wrong? We've got to decide with beauty. Why do we think something can be beautiful? What makes the most sense? That there's a God who has put beauty out there, who has instilled beauty into us? Or that we're just cosmic space dust with time? And we just have decided this. Justice. Why does it bother us when something's unfair? Do you think it bothers the sharks and those without the image of God impressed upon them? You know, anything that we value, honor and valor and you know, the chivalry and those types of things. Where does that come from? If there's nothing out there that gives it meaning, it's just a pretend game. All you are is stardust plus time plus chance. See, those are questions we've got to answer. Look, if there is no God, as Paul would say about the resurrection, eat, drink, and be merry because there's no tomorrow. So when he says, I'm a golden rule atheist, and I said, you're not that good at being a golden ruler. I mean, you let all that dear grandma go to waste. Here's his problem. He doesn't believe, Mike doesn't believe in God, but like it or not, he lives in a biblical world. And by that I mean, this is the world that is set up by the fundamentals of the Christian worldview. You will not find anything that explains this world, the world and us, fully like the Christian worldview. If you take the Christian worldview of fundamentals, the idea that there is an infinite personal and moral God, and that people matter because we're made in His image, and yet we have sinned and transgressed who He is, and we fail to live up to His morality. And He has communicated to us the critical nature of this and what's going on. He became human in Jesus, and He died, was buried, and physically resurrected for our sins. And because of that, death is not the end of our existence. Those are the Christian fundamentals that explain the world and the way it is. Those are the Christian fundamentals that explain us and the way we are. And if you don't agree with those, I will show you where you are living inconsistently with your belief system. You may say, I don't believe, but your life lives in the biblical world, whether you want to or not. Look, you can pretend you live somewhere else, but you are living in a biblical world. either the biblical view is right or it's not. If it is right, I don't care if you believe it or not. That's where you are. And so if you don't believe in God, and yet you're living in a Christian world, somewhere your life is not consistent with your belief system. And that's what I was trying to show Mike. His life is not consistent. He wants to live by the golden rule. That's not consistent with his worldview. So yes, it is, because it means that everybody else can get along better. Not necessarily, and not always. And then he's not living by the golden rule. He's living by what he thinks gets him the most. So this is why C.S. Lewis said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen. Not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. That's what makes sense. And so as we go through this week, step three, that's what we're going to do. Tomorrow, I want to look at Daniel Dennett. I want to look at Christopher Hitchens. I want to look at Richard Dawkins. And I want to look at Sam Harris, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, who are the four most well-read, quoted atheists that are evangelistic for why God doesn't exist. And I want to look at their arguments. And I want to put them in the scales. And I want to see what makes more sense. Because I honestly believe Mike's comment, can you prove it, is one that I can answer with yes. As a lawyer, I can. So I'm excited about tomorrow. Can I have a word of prayer with you before we end? Our Lord and our God, open our hearts, clean out our ears, sharpen our minds. Reveal yourself to us. Renew how we think. Capture our hopes and aspirations and dreams. Be real in your presence to us, confirming in your spirit with our spirit. And helping us think through things not only for our own faith, Father, but for ways to share your reality with this world. Thank you for this school. I thank you for each person here. I thank you for each person involved in administration, teaching, but especially each student who's spending their time and energy to seek to serve you. And I pray that you will bless each one by name. In Jesus our Lord, amen. See you guys in the morning.